House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is April 7th, 2015. First item on the agenda is public hearing, possible work session, House Bill 2317. Gail Meyer, Lisa Maxfield, Ken Noly.
And Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2317, as introduced, extends the statute of limitations from 10 years to 12 years for an action for recovery of real property or for recovery of possession of real property. We are considering the proposed Dash 4 amendments, which replace the entire bill. The amendments provide that a prosecution for a crime of rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, and sexual abuse in the first degree may be commenced within 12 years after the commission of the offense. It specifies that if the victim was a minor at the time of the offense, prosecution may be commenced either within 12 years or before the victim attains age 30. We have the paperwork back, and we are ready to move on.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, thank you for to the chair for allowing us this opportunity to present our remarks at this time. OCDLA would also like to honor and acknowledge and thank the proponents of this bill, specifically Brenda Tracy and Danielle Tudor. They did reach out to us affirmatively. They knew that we would have concerns, and they came to our legislative committee, and we set up a separate meeting with them, and we had in-depth discussions, and we really did try to find a common ground and found at some point after lengthy discussion that our interests were so variant that we couldn't find it. But I do want to acknowledge and thank them for the courtesy and the respect that they afforded our association. So thank you to that. In acknowledging the bill, I do want to ask the committee to please recognize, as we talk through our comments here, that the two proponents here, Ms. Tudor and Ms. Tracy, did the right thing. They came forward and they promptly reported their assaults. There were forensic examinations taken, there were pictures taken, there were statements taken, and in the instance of Ms. Tracy, there were arrests made of the accused assailants and statements taken from them. It is possible at this stage, 16 years later, to look back and feel quite confident in knowing that a horrible, horrible assault occurred. What I hope the committee appreciates and understands here is that there's no requirement in the bill for an immediate report or for the capturing of forensic proof at the time or close to the time of the event. It simply takes that six-year marker and moves it backwards to 12. We also want to acknowledge that many Oregon criminal defense lawyers' clients have been victims of violent assaults, and we're very aware of how that can impact the trajectory of someone's life. But we are also aware that not all allegations are truthful and not all allegations are accurate. And we do see that in the context of our cases. Cases right now that are made, allegations right now are made, are sometimes conclusively proven by law enforcement to be false. The example of that most recently is the Woodburn allegation of a gang rape by four Latino males. The woman acknowledged 3 days later she had made the claim up. It is also possible at this time, sometimes even upon indictment, the defense kicks in and starts to investigate a case, and the defense retrieves evidence that conclusively proves falsehood, and the DAs dismiss the charges. And it is also the case that sometimes these cases are simply presented to a jury, and a jury promptly returns a not guilty within a matter of minutes. So the unfortunate but truthful part of it is, not all claims are accurate nor true. We think that good policy is policy that promotes prompt reporting. Everyone is well served in the event of a prompt report. The system is well served, the victim is well served, the accused is well served, the jury is well served, and the correction system is well served. And we say this for a couple reasons. Number one, we believe that there's a public safety issue here. In the event that there's a violent sexual assault, then there is a violent sexual assailant out there walking around interfacing with the public. We submit that it's good public policy to promote procedures, services, systems in place that help and facilitate a victim to come forward and follow through with prosecution when that's the case. We also submit that the criminal justice system has inherent limitations within it. It is dependent upon all the faults and strengths and failures and foibles of the human condition. From the allegation to the investigation, to the defense, to the prosecution, to the adjudication by the court, to the jury. There can be error anywhere along the line. The system is at its strength when there's evidence that can be brought into a court of law, that can be subjected to scrutiny, and the combative efforts of the adversarial process. We also admit that Oregon is different from other states. And if there is a state in the union that by right should have a short limitation period, we submit that that state is Oregon. And we say that for a few reasons. Number one, Oregon has a non-unanimous jury verdict. That is not the norm. 48 states and the federal system require unanimity. The only other state that allows for a non-unanimous jury verdict of 10 to 2 is Louisiana. Oregon was unanimous at the time of statehood. The District Attorneys Association sought a referral in the 30s to go out and amend the Constitution to allow for a 10-2 jury verdict. The ACLU wasn't around then. OCDLA hadn't been invented then. And there was no opposition to the referral, and it passed. But Oregon and Louisiana are the only two states that allow for a 10-2 jury verdict. So if you look at across the United States, all other 48 states and the federal system, they have to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt to the count of 12. In Oregon, there can be two jurors pounding the table, asserting the government has not proven this beyond a reasonable doubt. And that does not matter in Oregon. That person is to be convicted. What we know from social studies with non-unanimous jury verdicts, the voices that get excluded are the minority voices and persons who have a marginal edge, whether it be political views, whether it be racial, whether it be age, whether it be ethnic. Whomever it does not fit the norm is usually the ones that are on the outside of that two count non-unanimous verdict. Oregon is different for another reason. We have very limited discovery rights afforded to the accused, much less than in other states. If you just look at the contiguous states to Oregon by comparison, you'll see what we're saying. If you go to the north in Washington, they have pretrial depositions. So you have the right to go submit people, have them come in, sworn on the record, ask them questions about the allegation prior to trial. In Oregon, by contrast, crime victims' rights have rights which bar the defense from even contacting them, let alone requesting an interview. To the south of us in California, they proceed by way of preliminary hearing. So 10 days after an arrest in open court, a complainant is on the stand, subject to cross-examination by the accused in open court under oath. Again, in Oregon, there's no opportunity to question a complainant prior to trial. In Idaho and Nevada, they have fully recorded grand juries, and they give the entirety of the record over to the accused upon a charge. We do not record the grand jury here in Oregon. I'll acknowledge efforts by Representative Williams and Representative Krieger to make a change there, but that has not crossed the line yet. So in those other states, those sworn statements before the grand jury are recorded, and the accused has given them a copy of that sworn testimony. Oregon alone, in that contiguous area, has 9 unanimous jury verdicts and no right of the defendant to know anything about what the allegation is other than what's contained in the police reports. I'll also acknowledge that this bill has a charge in there of sex abuse 1, which is not commonly reflected in other states that have longer limitation periods. Sex abuse 1 is sexual contact. It is a touching of an intimate area. Intimate area is not defined as genitalia or breasts. It's defined as a subjective belief that an area of their body is intimate and protected and ought not be touched. So there have been convictions for rubbing of a thigh, nibbling of an ear, stroking of a cheek or the neck. So in the Dash 4 amendment is inclusive of the crimes that the limitation period is being extended, is including sex abuse 1, which is simply, and I don't mean to minimize it, but what I mean to say is it is completed upon a touch. We've also looked at other state statutes. We are aware that there are many states that you can look to say that Oregon has a shorter limitation period at the shorter end. But many of those states distinguish between violent rape and non-consensual rape. Violent rape being something with serious physical injury or a deadly dangerous weapon. Oregon does not distinguish between violent rape and non-consensual rape. So they are all inclusive within the same. As I mentioned, we did try to find a middle ground. There are other states you can look at. Washington has a particular feature that's unusual. It says if you promptly report within a year, then you get your extended limitation period. If you don't promptly report within a year, then the limitation period is 3. We looked at that. We can't propose it. But what we do acknowledge here is that we tried to find a middle ground, and we just simply couldn't find one. In the final analysis, we believe that given the procedural protections that are existent in Oregon, non-unanimous jury verdicts and minimal discovery rights, that the current limitation period of 6 years is as far as things should go. Thank you.
Thank you. And I want to thank you for trying to work us out ahead of time.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to address you regarding House Bill 2317. My name's Lisa Maxfield. I'm a criminal defense lawyer from Portland, Oregon. But most of my cases are tried outside of Portland. I tend to go to every county throughout the state. I think I've been in most of them. And usually when I'm outside of county, I am trying a sex crime. Last week when I was here, listening to the stories of the women who testified before this committee, I thought, I was just sitting there thinking, who could even imagine for a second that these women aren't deserving of justice? And wondering whether the statute of limitations couldn't be wiggled or changed in a way that would give them the opportunity to have their trial and to have their stories heard and hopefully have some kind of justice. But as I thought about it over the weekend, the truth is, the justice system that I work in is imperfect. It's imperfect because we rely on memory. It's imperfect because we ask the jury to judge credibility. It's just imperfect and enough times reaches the incorrect result. While these women are entitled to justice, and I'd like to see it happen, the truth is that justice is about getting the correct result, not just having a trial. And what Gail asked me to share with you are a few stories from my clients where we were able to prove, actually quite convincingly, because we had access to evidence that they had not committed the crimes that they had been accused of, and then to ask whether that same evidence would be available to them if this statute of limitations had been extended or the report delayed. And I have to tell you, I honestly can't imagine how in several of these cases we could have put a defense together. Let me give you an example. I had a kid in Jackson County. He was 18 years old, a freshman in college, and ended up having sexual intercourse with an older girl in the dorms one night. He later found himself charged with rape in the first degree, and her allegation was that she had been rendered unconscious from a pain medication. She alleged that the intercourse occurred while she was completely passed out. My client, because he was just kind of a goofy kid, had a difficult time giving me a lot of detail, but he kept saying, no, she was there, she was awake. And finally one day he said to me, one of the ways he knew that she was awake is because she had been texting both before and after the event. So we got the cell records, and what we were able to see is literally like 75 text messages that led up to a 6-minute interval with no text messages. And then what followed that were another 100 text messages immediately afterwards. So we were able to find our 6-minute window for intercourse, but we were also able to show that that woman was conscious. She was conscious 6 minutes before the sexual encounter and conscious immediately after the sexual encounter. Most cell records are only preserved for like 5 years. So if the statute of limitations had been extended or if this woman's report had not come when it did and we were forced to try the case, I'd had a goofy kid who would have told what probably would have sounded like a very implausible account of texting, sex, texting. And it would have been very difficult for him to have achieved the result that we did in that case. As soon as the prosecutor saw the text threads, he agreed that the case probably wasn't a good one and that it should be dismissed. In another case in Yamhill County, we also used cell records, but we used them in a different way. In this case, my 18-year-old client met a girl on the internet who was 16, and they had sexual intercourse. Everyone agreed there was sex. The issue was whether it had been forced or whether it was consensual. The key evidence in that case had been destroyed. My client told me that the girl had taken a selfie of the two of them after the sexual encounter. The police admitted to seeing a photo that might have looked like a kissing selfie, but they returned the phone to the girl, and so that evidence was destroyed. In an effort to try to build some sort of a defense, we got the text records and the cell phone records. We were able to find 10 people who that girl talked to immediately after the sexual encounter. In the interviews, those 10 people told us that when describing what had occurred that night, she either described nothing of moment or she described a consensual encounter with my client. If we fast-forwarded this and my client found himself accused under the statute of limitations that you're proposing, the text records and the cell records would be gone, destroyed probably 5 years earlier. Would we have been able to find these witnesses? No. And even if we could find these witnesses, because we're talking about, you know, 16, 17-year-old kids, would they have a memory of the night that they talked to this woman? They just wouldn't. That's how it works in our business. We're trying to build defenses out of details, hard details that help a jury break the tie in a he said, she said prosecution. And I have to tell you, it's not always a tie. Most of the time in my cases, the person who's been accused finds himself on the short side of that stick. And he does it for the same reasons that all of us had such sympathy and have such sympathy for the women who came before you. When we hear that a woman has accused someone of a sexual assault, all of our assumptions is, why on earth would you say that if it's not true? And that just very subtly shifts the burden to the defendant to prove why someone might make a false accusation and then to actually prove with hard evidence that they did. It's that hard evidence that disappears over time and certainly would disappear over the extended statute of limitations. I had another case, a Facebook page. My client had been accused of sexually abusing a girl, and we found on the Facebook page some posts where she was talking with some friends of hers about a psychiatric hospitalization, which we didn't know about. No one had shared that with us, and it certainly wasn't in the police reports. When we got the psychiatric records, having been clued in by the Facebook page, we were able to determine that she had a borderline personality disorder and some very serious mental issues. When that information was shared with the prosecutor, she agreed, again, that this was a case that perhaps had been better not brought. That case occurred, I think, 5 years ago. When I checked before coming for this hearing, the Facebook page that had clued us into the problem was gone. Many years ago, many years ago, I won a child sex case in Albany simply using the lawyer's log notes. Lawyers are asked to keep their records for 7 years, but they don't have to.
What kind of lawyer?
Keep them any longer than that.
Which lawyer?
Huh? Which lawyer?
Yeah. Whose lawyer's log note?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. There had been a custody dispute, so it was my client's divorce lawyer's log notes, and we were able to show how there had been this long-standing, protracted battle where the mom in that case had used many, many, many different tools to try to engineer custody and the output. A few years ago, I had a case in Jackson County where 5 years before the indictment, the complaining witness in that case, who was a teenager, had been interviewed on video at one of these kid assessment centers. And during that videotaped interview, told the police that she had not been sexually abused by my client. Later, 5 years later, she changed her story and said, no, in fact, she had. Understanding this was going to be a he said, she said, we immediately wanted to get the earlier videotape. what we were told is that that videotape, just 5 days before indictment, had been destroyed in the normal course of business. In that case, my client was convicted. But I've always wondered whether the outcome might have been different had the jury been given the benefit of having two videotaped interviews, one in which she said it happened and one in which she said she didn't. In evidence in these kinds of cases, as I said before, justice means getting the correct result, not just a trial. A trial in and of itself is not justice. Justice is when the jury reaches the conclusion that's the accurate conclusion, the correct conclusion. Having a trial and sending an innocent man to jail for something he didn't do isn't necessarily justice, even if everybody got their day in court. For those of us who know that we have represented innocent clients, the idea that the statute of limitations would be extended is very frightening. Because in Oregon, there's no way to kind of fix it. I grew up in Utah, where the judge could fix what they thought was an erroneous jury verdict. They could fix it either by just taking the verdict away, or they could fix it by adjusting the penalty. But in Oregon, we have these mandatory penalties. The power has left the judge's hands. So if a jury makes a mistake, there really isn't any way for the judge to make a correction. In Oregon, we don't have great discovery. It's stingy. We're often trying to figure out what happened literally as people are on the witness stand. So the only other sources we have are these hard sources, the documents, the witness memories that haven't faded. We're out there in the field literally trying to put together evidence that isn't offered to us in police reports or anything that comes from the state. More often than not, we're building that fabric ourselves. In Oregon, we allow verdicts without unanimous verdicts. I have to tell you more times than not, with my guilty verdicts, it's 10-2. That means two people had a reasonable doubt, 10 didn't. My point is we've already diluted the procedural safeguards that might make up for an extended statute of limitations. But when you already have a system that has taken away protections that might be available in other states, the notion that we would once more dilute the chance of an innocent person proving that he didn't commit the sex crime that he's been accused of would be a grave disappointment, and I urge this committee not to pass the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Williamson and Olson, and the committee. My name is Ken Nolley. I'm a retired professor from Willamette University, and I'm here as president of Oregon Voices. Many of you know that OV is an organization of families who have someone on the registry, and we are here often talking about their interests and their concerns from that perspective. I'm here today to say that this is a really hard place for me to be because I have feet firmly on both sides of this question. In my 47 years at Willamette, I've had students who were raped, and I've sat with them and felt helpless as I watched them struggle with the pain and the anger that they felt in trying to recover from it. I have a niece who I'm very close to who was raped while she was in college, and I've been with her and my sister and my brother-in-law and commiserated with them on the rage and frustration they felt about it. Those of us in OV always have, we're still family people, and we're still exposed to all of the concerns that everybody else has. I've spent a lifetime in academia as a committed feminist. I've taught courses in women's studies, and I've been in rooms over and over again where colleagues of mine said, if a woman says she's been raped, she's been raped. And at this point, I'm ashamed to say I've sat through those things and assented silently, perhaps, but didn't say anything, even if I wasn't entirely convinced. But the last 6 years of doing the work I do have shown me that, as you've already heard, it ain't always so. I think hardly a month goes by when I don't encounter yet another case of someone who makes a strong argument that they were charged and found guilty of a crime that they didn't do, of a sex crime that they didn't do. In any individual case, it's impossible, of course, to know if that's true or not. But some of these stories are really, really compelling. And they come with a certain set of, with a certain pattern that seems to get repeated over and over again. In these cases, there's no forensic evidence, so we tend to be reduced, as you've already heard, to he said, she said. But also, these cases often come up later at the moment when there's a relationship that's broken up, when there's a divorce, when there's a bitter dispute in a family, or a bitter dispute in a small social group. Those patterns come back over and over again, and they make lots of these charges deeply suspect. But I don't know very many cases where people haven't been found guilty. I think everyone in this room is probably aware of the Rolling Stone article on the rape at University of Virginia that came out in December. It really caught my attention because I'm an alum of UVA, and I read that article. I was deeply moved by it. I was angry, probably the way that most readers were. And because I remembered nearly 50 years ago behavior from some of those fraternities that I thought was less than stellar, it was easy for me to believe that that was true. As we all know, in the last several months, that story has unraveled badly. I don't know if all of you followed the most recent developments, but Rolling Stone commissioned the Columbia School of Journalism, probably the premier school of journalism in the country, to do a review of the story, and their report came out this week. And it's a scathing indictment of the failure of Rolling Stone to apply its normal, rigorous journalistic standards to the story. But the story is also a kind of warning. It's an illustration of how easy it is when we're so convinced by and so empathetic with a victim or someone we're convinced is a victim, and we let that override procedural safeguards. That's true in journalism, it's true in academia, and it's true in the criminal justice system. And you here are setting the conditions of that system. So I would like to join my colleagues here in urging you not to accept this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Lots of good points that were brought up. I'm going back to what hasn't changed is guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And so as I look at that, and you mentioned several cases that didn't go to trial, and it sounds like they probably shouldn't have gone to trial. But once the trial begins and you have beyond reasonable doubt, how many of those cases, if you can come up with any numbers for me, where it is only he said, she said, only he said, she said, that there's a conviction? If those, very many of those, get to trial. Because most prosecutors, most investigators want more than, I say he did this.
That's for you.
Addressing it to me.
Anybody.
Actually, one of the cases that I talked about, the kid who, with the selfie, and then we found the records that led us to the witnesses, that was actually a case that went to trial, and the jury acquitted him. So even though the prosecutor had that evidence, no, we were in trial, and it was a he said, she said. And the only thing to break the tie was the evidence that the defense brought. And I guess it depends on what you call corroborating evidence. Typically in child sex abuse cases, it's he said, she said. But the corroborating evidence is she said it, and she said it, and she said it. So we have the child who goes through an assessment center, is interviewed, says it on videotape. And that tends to be the evidence to corroborate what the child says in court. That's your corroborating evidence. She said it, and then she said it again. What we don't see is, and this is just because of the nature of the beast, what you don't see in child sex abuse cases, it's very rare, would be any physical evidence to corroborate that. The other corroboration might come from parents, so-and-so, or maybe just the fact that the alleged abuser had access to the kid or contact with the kid. But there wouldn't be, usually it's really just sizing up those witnesses on the witness stand and trying to decide which one's being truthful. It happens, I think, in the vast majority of cases with child sex abuse. The other truth, though, with, and I see a lot of these college cases, you know, where you just get, and I was telling Gail, you just get this period where, not, I know there are differences, but in the cases that I see young men who haven't picked up on the cues about whether they, whether consent is real or not, but I also see young women who are not stating their objection out loud, and this is all being negotiated non-verbally, and it, at least in my experience, not particularly well, and that's when we find our, my clients charged. Many prosecutors find it very difficult to walk away from an accusation of abuse. It's much easier to let the jury decide than to have to take the political heat of making that decision themselves. And almost always they'll present it to a grand jury. It's just difficult not to give the accusing person the benefit of the doubt. So, yeah, I see those a lot. And I guess it just depends on your corroborating evidence. There's the kind of corroborating evidence that says, we're home free. I just read a transcript where it was an old case. I think the incident had occurred in 2000, and the woman was 14. She didn't make a report until she was 24. But one of the facts that she said was that the alleged rapist had, they'd seen on television one of those ads. Remember those 900 numbers where you would call for sex? Now we have the internet. You don't see those anymore. But she said that he had made an advertisement to come on from one of those 900 things, and that he had asked her to make the call, and that that's what had initiated the assault. And I thought to myself, well, that's easy. You would just go back and get, she either made, that either happened or it didn't. The call was either made or it wasn't. The ad was either on or it wasn't. And if we had, if you got that fresh enough, either the prosecution wins or the defense wins, but that single fact would break the tie. But you wouldn't know now because that evidence is gone.
If I could answer it to Representative Springer, I have less access to the facts of the case, admittedly, from the beginning. And I would also say that Voices is much more likely to hear of cases. We're not likely to hear of the cases where people were exonerated. We're much more likely to hear cases where they're not. But over and over again, I've heard stories of where it was just that. It was just, there was no corroborating evidence. It was simply an accusation that led to a conviction. The one case that I know of, that we happen to know of, and I've just heard of in the last couple of months, took place in Albany, and I think Representative Olson probably knows about the case. Where a father was accused of abusing his children by a neighbor. The family had resources, and they fought a case really publicly for 2 years, and he was exonerated. But that's not the story that we usually hear in Oregon Voices.
Chair Barker, if I might. Representative Springer, just as a matter of law, if a defendant confesses, by law, there needs to be some corroboration of that confession. But the reverse is true with an accusation. The allegation of a single witness, uncorroborated by any other evidence, if believed by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, constitutes sufficient evidence for a conviction. So lawfully, a witness's testimony, if believed beyond a reasonable doubt, is sufficient evidence to convict. There's no legal requirement for corroboration. Like there is, yeah, there is an obligation for corroboration with a confession, but not an accusation.
But they have to get it through the trial. You have to convince the jury. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but these, what we're not hearing about all the cases who either hit grand jury or don't get through, and in order to successfully prosecute a case, it's not easy. If you have just he said, she said, it usually goes beyond that. So that would be my comment.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Comment, a question. The comment is, please don't rely on Rolling Stone for journalism unless you just want to follow the Grateful Dead's tour. I wouldn't. That, just my advice being in the business. Gail, seriously, though, I want to thank you for bringing a lot of things to attention on this, you know, helping. me get through this. Do you have the dash four in front of you by chance, so I could read?
No, I do not. No.
You don't?
Does it read differently than the dash three?
Because I have a question that you mentioned, and I think you would have to look at it to know where I'm at. On that first page, I guess it would be line 18.
Yes.
The D. Is that, so sexual abuse in the first degree under ORS 163-427, you just have to bear with me that I don't know all these ORSs. Is that what you were talking about earlier about touching, that sort of thing?
Chair Barker, Representative Post, that is the crime, yes.
Okay, so if so, could you tell me, because I will admit that makes me uncomfortable a little bit too, in comparison to the ones above that. It makes me a little uncomfortable. And I guess I'm looking for maybe some help from you, Gail. I don't know how to word this. Not detail. I don't know what I'm trying to say. Not detail, but other example. Oh, man, I don't even want to go there. I don't want to turn into Law and Order SVU. I just.
Chair Barker, Representative Post, it really is as simple as what I articulated. Sexual abuse is sexual contact done for sexual gratification or arousal. The touching does not need to be of an genitalia or breast. It can be of an intimate body part. Intimate body part is interpreted by the courts to be a subjective consideration. So I considered this to be an intimate body, a part of my body that should have been entitled to be free of any kind of sexual arousing touch. And so convictions have been secured and affirmed on appeal for rubbing of a thigh, a nibbling of an ear, a touching, a stroking of a neck. It can be a creepy thing to do that. And the courts have affirmed that that can constitute sex abuse in the first degree. It is a B felony. It is a Measure 11 crime, and it has a mandatory minimum of 70 months. Yeah.
Yes, but Gail, what are the other elements? We're looking at it, and it's the victim is less than 14, the victim is subjected to forcible compulsion, or the victim is incapable of consent.
Chair Barker, Representative Post, yes. But
I mean, that's a difference between a sex abuse one and a sex abuse two, is those elements.
Yes. And if you have a complainant who is less than 14, then it can be with those. And very frequently, your child sex abuse cases involve sex abuse one. They do. Most of them do. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Pat.
Close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2317.
Chair Barker, I move to adopt the dash four amendments into House Bill 2317.
Representative Williams moves the dash four in House Bill 2317. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair, I be truthful with you. I mean, I've dealt with this for some time. I struggle with sex abuse first degree being part of this. I understand what the elements are. I am very familiar with that. I don't see placing a Class B felony in the mix with three A felonies.
Okay, thank you. Anything further?
I would echo that sentiment.
That's a good point.
So we'll take a vote on putting the dash fours in. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Greenlight?
Excused.
Oh, he's right here.
He's right here.
Sorry. He snuck in on
me. You were late. You were late.
Right ahead. Now's
the time to vote no.
Yeah. You can excuse me from this one. I'll vote yes on the amendment.
Thank you.
Representative Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Post?
Sorry, I just got confused.
We're putting the amendment. This for the amendment.
Yes,
dash for amendment.
dash four amendment.
Dash four is funny.
Okay.
The dash four amendment. Okay.
But with what you and I just addressed.
Yeah.
That can be addressed separately?
No.
No.
Well, the amendment will go into the bill, but you can have a final vote on it once we take the final tally on the bill. So this is
you
just
vote on
the
it twice.
Can we take a recess for a moment?
Yes. Is that appropriate?
Can we do that?
Yep. Stand out. Stand at ease for
all my criminal experience.
Call the committee back to order. We'll continue the vote.
Okay. Aye.
Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Williamson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. The dash fours are in.
Chair Barker, I move House Bill 2317 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves House Bill 2317 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Are there any discussions? Representative Greenlight.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm new at this committee, and this is a new experience for me, and I was very troubled by the hearing to hear the horrible stories of the women that had been raped. Since that, I've been talking to legal experts, trying to get an understanding of what the underlying philosophy is for statutes of limitations. And I thought maybe if I could get to the underlying philosophy, I could have some assessment of whether, in this case, 6 years is right, or 12 years is right, or 20 years is right, or 1,000 years is right. I can't find any underlying philosophy. I've talked to people, including a retired Supreme Court justice. I am troubled by the notion, I have come to believe, that we have a philosophy in the judicial system to make the punishment fit the crime. And while I've had problems with Measure 11, I understand as we have more serious crimes, we have longer sentences, and that seems to me making the punishment fit the crime rational. But somehow it seems that the statute of limitations gets mixed up with the penalty for the crime, and I sense the statute of limitations shouldn't be in that. They should rather be about the administration of justice. And when I ask people what's the problem with extending the statute of limitations, I get, I think, a cogent argument that it makes it more difficult to defend the longer the statute of limitations are. It makes it easier to bring a case, obviously, because some are brought after a shorter statute of limitations is expended, but that it makes it harder to defend the case at that point, and I think we heard some testimony on this regard. I also came to the sense that there needs to be closure somewhere. And I think the problem is we're trying to decide whether we have closure for a potential defendant or closure for a potential witness. And extending the statute of limitations doesn't necessarily make for more closure, I think, for the victim. And it certainly doesn't make for more closure for somebody who might be a potential defendant in a case. So, I mean, I'm sufficiently troubled by this to be willing to take the difficult vote of no on this measure, because I don't know whether 12 years or 20 years or never is better than 6 years. So I don't know what the basis of extending it from 6 years to 12 years is. Oh, and I say it's been a serious consideration, and
thank you.
I'll be a no vote.
Okay, thank you, Representative. And it also is harder to prove a case that's older, so I think that would factor in. And I think I've been convinced by the testimony of the women who talk about the devastation in their lives, and so I think sometimes it takes longer to report, and that's why I'm going to be a yes vote on it. But, Representative Williamson.
I want to make a comment to follow up on what Gail said about our procedural issues in the state in the criminal justice system and in criminal trials. And as you all know, I have a bill to record grand juries for this very reason, as I think that we are unique as a state in the lack of process we have on the defense side and the fact that we do not have unanimous jury verdicts. And so I am a supporter of this bill. But I do know that those are issues that I'm working on because I think everything, I think we need to balance those out, and those are some easy steps to make sure that we're providing the process required.
Okay, thank you.
Any further comments?
Okay. Did you move the bill?
We did.
We did, okay.
Call the roll.
Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Greenlight.
No.
Representative Leininger.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye. Aye.
Representative Post.
Yes. Oh, sorry. Aye.
Representative Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Williamson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries.
I can carry it. Whoever wants, I can do it.
Okay. Representative Williamson will carry the bill. And we'll open the next, open a public hearing on House Bill 3498 and call Representative Escobar, please.
Yeah. I think Ann Lee Martin. It was the question.
For the record, Sal Escobar, Representative District 6, Medford. House Bill 3498. Well, you want to probably say what it is.
Yeah. I think you're in the wrong committee anyway.
Yeah.
So I'll just tell you briefly about it. Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3498 is sponsored by Representative Escobar. We don't have the paperwork back on this yet. We don't have any amendments before us today. So currently, any person in Oregon who acts as an outfitter or guide must first and annually register with the State Marine Board. Registration requires an affidavit from the applicant stating that they have not been convicted of certain crimes, consisting mostly of permitting or wildlife violations in the previous 24 months. The board currently has the authority to take action, including suspension, revocation, or denial against outfitters and guides who have committed certain violations. House Bill 3498 additionally requires applicants to state by affidavit that they have not been convicted in the previous 24 months of 1. Crimes involving the delivery, manufacture, or possession of controlled substances, as defined by ORS 475.005, or 2. Assault in any degree, criminal homicide, as defined by ORS 163.005, or kidnapping. The bill also requires applicants to state by affidavit that they have never been convicted of 1. A crime prohibiting them from possessing a firearm, or 2. A crime requiring them to register as a sex offender in certain instances. The bill expands the list of the Legislative Assembly list of violations directly related to fitness required for registration. It clarifies current language regarding revocation. It authorizes the board in its discretion to reprimand, suspend for up to 24 months, revoke or deny registrations for serious or repeated violations of small watercraft statutes, and also convictions and involving controlled substances and convictions of assault in any degree, criminal homicide, kidnapping in any degree. The bill has additional clarifying applications, and it authorizes the board to take action before the operative date of January 1st, 2016 in order to enact changes, and applies to applications for initial or renewed registration received by the board on or after the effective date. And it does declare an emergency and is effective on passage.
Any questions?
Yeah, I
well, he that was a joke. He's good.
Colleagues, Mr. Chair and colleague, House Bill 3498 closes a gap in Oregon's outfitter and guide registration laws. Specifically, this bill provides direction and authority to the Marine Board to condition, revoke, suspend, or deny registration of an individual who, as a result of conviction, must register as a sex offender or is prohibited from carrying a firearm. This bill is a reasonable approach and does authorize the individual's ability to rehabilitate through the justice system. This bill establishes a new requirement for reporting of crimes. This bill also addresses the inequality of the Marine Board to have the ability to revoke a guide license for multiple hunting and fishing violations, but can do nothing about a hunting guide who has a felony assault and is prohibited from carrying a firearm. It is important to note that all individuals who are denied an outfitter or guide license by the Marine Board have the right to appeal this decision to an administrative law judge. This is also a permissive bill as well for the board. So I'll turn it over to my colleagues here.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name's Joe Rollator. I live in Walport, Oregon. I've been a guide, and I have represented the McKenzie River Guide Association for many years, and that's the oldest guide association in Oregon. And I grew up on that river, so I have a great connection to them. I also am on the Marine Board's Guide Advisory Committee as the public member. Since I've become a lobbyist and I'm not an active guide anymore, I'm the public member. In about 1980, I was a charter boat operator in Depot Bay. We had some public safety issues with bad operators. And my charter boat association sent me over to talk to the guides and packers about registration or some kind of government regulation. And we started an almost 35-year journey on professionalism within the guiding association. We've tried to increase professionalism amongst the guides and public safety with our clients. The idea of this bill, we thought we had many of the problems that we had with the guiding industry solved with the 2013 bill, but we discovered, as Representative Esquivel pointed out, there's some public safety issues that people have been are not covered by what the Marine Board can revoke a license for now, and so this bill brings that into compliance. And Randy Henry is here from the Marine Board, and he can talk about the specifics of this.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Randy Henry. I'm the Boating Safety Program Manager for the State of Oregon and have worked through the Guide Advisory Committee since 2010 to update, take a new look at some of the laws related to outfitting and guiding. The subject for House Bill 3498, I think, came up in January at our Guide Advisory Committee meeting as we were doing a year-end review, looking at some of the things that improved administration and oversight had helped us understand related to outfitter guides. That was past the point where the Marine Board could go through the governor's office for the legislative process. So with that said, Joe, I believe, took some of the concerns noted by the GAC and brought them forward in this bill. Because of that, the Marine Board is neutral on House Bill 3498. I think it's been described the basics of what the bill does, but there are a couple things that I would want to note from our point of view, and that's that the bill establishes the new requirement to report crimes. If a person is convicted of a crime and is either prohibited from carrying a firearm or required to register as a sex offender, the individual outfitter and guide license would be revoked upon conviction. However, the following year, the following January, when the new license period opened up, that individual would be able to reapply, and that would be a point where additional information could be provided at that time. It's important to note that any person aggrieved by a decision of the Marine Board regarding issuance or denial of an outfitter and guide registration is entitled to judicial review of the decision in accordance with the procedures for contested cases provided in ORS Chapter 183. I should note that so far in 2015, just for context, we have revoked one outfitter and guide license. It did go through the administrative law judge review, and the decision was upheld, and that was for multiple fishing and hunting type of violations. House Bill 3498 is a result of discussions with the outfitter and guide community, specifically the Guide Advisory Committee, convened under ORS 704.525. The committee's been meeting regularly since 2010, and in 2013 brought increased fees upon themselves to help provide better administration. So we can spend more time looking at the applications, reviewing those affidavits, and in certain cases looking at the Oregon Justice Information Network for issues with regarding recent convictions. In 2015, as a result of this improved oversight through the advisory board process, we have processed over 950, almost 1,000 guide applications. Because of the increased scrutiny, we returned almost 400 of those, and many of those applications were for insurance forms that were too generic. They didn't state that they were specifically insured for outfitting and, say, hunting activities, for fishing and hunting activities. That's an example of the extra oversight that we're doing to make sure citizens of the state are protected and that they're going with guides who are properly insured. We have issued 15 conditional licenses for outfitter guides. These may be situations where the outfitter and guide either left a fact off or simply lied on their affidavit. In some situations, we may recommend revocation or a temporary suspension for that type of activity. So we have done 15 of those conditional type registrations for violations. We revoked one guide registration. We have another one pending at this time. We worked closely with the Oregon State Police to investigate another one potential, 21 potential criminal violations related to outfitting and guiding as well. Guides, law enforcement, and members of the public have expressed concern that certain registered sex offenders are allowed to take families into remote waterways or on backcountry hunting trips, or that individuals who use, manufacture, or sell illegal drugs are guiding people in rugged terrain or hazardous waterways. Those issues are brought forward to us on an occasional basis. I would have to say most guides are law-abiding citizens who perform admirably at what they do, taking people into the outdoors of Oregon and introducing them to hunting and fishing and other activities. But there are situations where that's not the case. Thank you for your time. Please allow me to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions, committee? Representative Greenland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I thought representative was excused.
I was excused for the bad behavior on the last bill, but not for this bill yet. This is yet to come. I'm intrigued with the notion of signing an affidavit that I haven't done these things. If you want to get a job as a nursing home orderly, you go down and get fingerprinted and there's a background check done. Why isn't that a part of this process as opposed to...
The law as it exists now has been an evolution, and frankly, you know, Joe's been more involved from the early days than I have. But it's been an evolution. Originally, this was much more of sort of a business license. If you had your insurance and CPR cards and you paid your $25, you too could be a guide. That has been ramped up. And at this point, we do have a process where if we see an individual application that appears to have some improper references, we will conduct a review through the Oregon Just Information Network to look for those types of things. We also have a process to review at regular intervals. Ideally, we would do that regular review for every single one, but the program is minimally funded, and that sort of background review takes an awful lot of time. That would increase the fees for outfitter guides beyond the current $150. It would be difficult to implement that.
Yeah, Phil?
Please.
Same question. How do you know something? How do you know a crime has occurred for one of your?
For Fish and Wildlife, excuse me, Chair Barker, Representative Greenlink. For Fish and Wildlife crimes, we are developing an improved communications scheme, I guess, with the Oregon State Police. We have a special contract with them to conduct investigations into outfitter guides. Investigating outfitter guide issues and complaints is difficult and time-consuming. It generally requires booking trips or making contacts with them through their Facebook pages and other things. As those are carried out, the state police have done an excellent job of keeping us informed of the progress of that, and when a case reaches disposition, they notify us. In other cases, we aren't notified and we have to go look. And sometimes that is through on a complaint basis, which is where those complaints from the public may come in and say, did you know such and such guide has had this issue? Can you look into it? So it's several different processes that occur.
Can I follow that up?
Yes, you can. Please.
Yeah, but let's say one of your offenses, assault. A guide is convicted of an assault. Do you have any way to get that information from the courts in any systematic way? Or is it just haphazard if you
there? Chair Barker, members of the committee, for certain types of violations, it's stipulated in statute that the Marine Board is to be notified. Without having that in front of me, I couldn't cite that specifically.
Right. But notified by whom?
By the courts.
Huh.
Representative Olson.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Randy, two things. One, the letter that you sent us, thank you. My last name is spelled O-L-S-O-N. Not that I want to point that out to you right now. Okay.
My apologies.
Not connected to the senator. All right. Second thing is, in your letter, you identify the last second to the last paragraph that you went around to improve it, but you identified that the public had expressed deep concern that certain registered sex offenders are allowed to take families into remote, and you said that in your testimony. You know, of what I know of sex offender registration, there are specific conditions that exist. I'm just trying to kind of catch where you're going with what your policy would be here through this law and what the law exists right now.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I believe the way this would work, being neutral on the bill, we have received calls, which was part of the discussion that we had with the Guide Advisory Committee, of individuals who were familiar with Outfitter Guides who were either working or preparing to register as Outfitter Guides. And from the context of state Marine Board law and rules, that was not something that we can consider in issuing that document. That, I think, is the extent of this language.
Okay, I guess I didn't quite understand what you just said, Tim.
Okay, I'm sorry. Chair Barker, members of the committee. We have received, in multiple instances over the last 2 to 3 years, concerns from law enforcement, from other outfitter guides, from members of the public, that certain individuals were planning to register as an outfitter guide or were actively outfitting and guiding. And were registered sex offenders. Part of our concern is, being a small agency, we don't want to implement a system where we're doing large amounts of, judicial review or looking at this individual and trying to figure out if they're appropriate for service, but having a standard where if that issue exists, that would determine whether or not the guide license was issued, in the same way that if a guide had been arrested for a large-scale poaching operation and the judge determined that their guide license should be revoked, which is allowed in statute, that's a very simple process. We revoke for the period of time that the judge indicated. Or if the judge didn't revoke but that information comes to us, then we can look at that and make a determination that we're going to revoke or suspend that for the year. We can't make any of those determinations for, say, an individual who's had their firearm privileges revoked or somebody who's registered as a sex offender, and I think that's where the language came from, is to clarify that we simply wouldn't license if that was the case initially upon conviction, and then in subsequent years that person would apply and report that in the affidavit the same way they would do fish and wildlife violations.
Follow up. Please. Are you familiar with what we did with House Bill 2549 2 years ago regarding the changing around of the three-tier system for sex offender registration?
No, I'm not.
Can I make a follow-up comment?
Yes, you can.
I think what I'm hearing Representative Olson ask is you would violate your registry conditions if you were to guide against your registry conditions. I think you guys are talking past each other.
Okay.
About what it means to just be on the registry and what the conditions of you being on the registry are. So you couldn't guide a group of children under certain conditions of the registry. So I think you're talking about a blanket prohibition against anybody on the registry, and Representative Olson is talking about your individual conditions because of your risk assessment. I think that's what just happened.
I think that's correct.
Okay.
Okay.
Very good.
Thank you for the clarification.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had spoke to Joe couple times regarding the concept. This is, the bill contains more than I realized it was going to. Line 19, a crime involving delivery of manufacturers. We may have someone who was convicted of that, spent time in jail, gets rehabilitated, gets out, does all the thing that he's supposed to do to become a decent citizen, and that past record alone would keep him from doing it, regardless of whether he was a sex offender or not. So we need to do something about that section. And it says assault in any degree. I can't remember, Mr. Chair, Andy, what are the degrees of assault, and which ones are they all felonies? No.
No, you have A, B, and C, so it's you have first, second, and third degree are all felonies, and then assault four is a misdemeanor. Yeah. But the first two are both.
Why would that A misdemeanor be any important than any other A misdemeanor? So I think there needs to be some amendments and some real thought given, because this committee, which you neither you don't sit on it, Sal, now. I think you did one time, didn't you?
No.
But at any rate, we're really concentrating on the fact that when people they go to the state pen, where they got, they're starting to have people who are mentoring them in there, they're getting them a driver's license, they're getting them a Social Security card, they're trying to find them a job, and then they come out. I got no problem with the sex offender part of it, but I might have people. Young men do stupid things. You know, you were young.
You mean I know.
And as a result of that, I think we need to take a real careful look about the assault part, the possession or manufacture of controlled substance sometime back in their life. If you applied this to every occupation, what are these people going to do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I believe that the board has the ability to, once they've gone through rehab or whatever, they can, they don't have to take their license.
Well, and I point out that for those crimes, it's only for the past 24 months.
Right.
Is the only restriction on that. It just is a recent event. Representative Leininger.
Thank you. Related to what Representative Krieger said, we're in this strange situation where a class of conduct that has been criminal is going to be made legal under Measure 91. And so since this looks backward, I would feel more comfortable if we could make sure that, well, and we're talking about how to deal with people who did something wrong that, you know, is no longer wrong. I have some concerns that people who 24 months before or 20 months before engaged in some conduct related to marijuana, which is probably not the main reason why you bringing this important bill, would subsequently be unable to do the work that they're trying to do, even though the conduct is not illegal anymore. And I'm hoping we could find a way to cabin that off from being grounds for someone not being able to engage in their chosen profession.
You don't have the paperwork ready to move it today, so there's time to move.
Right. But, Mr. Chair, I'd like to answer that.
Please.
I still believe that they have the ability, the board has the ability to say yes or no. And if that's the case, they would say that's not a problem.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. I have Bob Olson on here. Bob, did you want to testify or?
Thank you.
Okay, he's gone. Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3498 and open a hearing on two bills, 2365 and 2366. And, okay. Okay, go ahead.
So, Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2365 comes to us at the request of the House Interim Committee of Judiciary for the Oregon Law Commission. We don't have the paperwork back for this yet. The proposed -3 amendment for 2365 and the -2 amendment for 2366 are for us today. These amendments completely replace the measure. So now, this these amendments are the result of the Oregon Law Commission adoption records work. They follow up on a lot of the work done during the 2013 and 2014 legislative sessions. These are cleanup housekeeping aspects with clarification and some different elements added. And we'll hear a lot more about that from witnesses, of course.
Hey, there are amendments here with us.
One amendment was 29 pages long. We didn't do that, but you can get it on OLIS, and I'm not sure if the other one is printed.
I can't get 2366 on OLIS for some reason.
I'll call John DiLorenzo, Robin Pope. John, I think it's Whitner. And Carolyn Dahlquist, or I'm sorry, Caitlin Dahlquist for a question.
Thank you. Yeah, just go ahead and see her. That's fine. Right there? Great.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I am a partner at the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, enjoying my 35th year of law practice. But today I am appearing in my volunteer capacity as a member of the Oregon Law Commission and as the chair of the Adoption Work Group. Mr. Chair, throughout my tenure on the commission, I have had the pleasure to chair multiple work groups. But I must say that none of my past assignments have been as rewarding as chairing the Adoption Work Group. The group, which is one of our largest, it has 37 members, has representatives of the judiciary, the Judicial Department, the Department of Human Services, the Department of Justice, private attorneys who practice in family law and adoption areas, adoption agencies, birth mothers, adoptive parents, and most important, adoptees. In 2012, we were tasked with considering issues relating to accessing court records with respect to adoption files. That project led to a consensus product, which resulted in landmark legislation, which this committee approved in 2013, Senate Bill 623. Upon enactment, Oregon became the first state in the nation to recognize that an adopted person is entitled to know his or her story by accessing records that surrounded their birth and early years. Since then, many states are beginning to emulate Oregon's step in this direction and follow Oregon's leadership. Now, our work group also supported House Bill 1536 in 2014, which cleared up some issues that were identified by the Judicial Department following initial implementation of Senate Bill 623. And last August, not willing to merely rest on its laurels, the Commission tasked us with doing more with respect to the implementation of Senate Bill 623 and to consider the issues concerning readoptions. And as you will hear, a readoption is an adoption in Oregon designed to ratify an adoption that has taken place in a foreign country. House Bill 2365-3 is a gut and stuff complete standalone product that includes those issues and should have no fiscal impact, I am told. And I believe we're fortunate today to have Samantha Benton from the Oregon Judicial Department, who will hopefully let you know that. House Bill 2366-2 is also a gut and stuff amendment. It makes changes to fees that can be charged by various agencies for filings, records, and the like. Both printed bills, Mr. Chair, have been provided for subsequent referrals to Ways and Means. We believe that these amendments will now eliminate the fiscal impacts, and so should you decide to refer these bills to the floor with a due pass recommendation, we would ask that you also remember to request of the Speaker's office that the subsequent referral be dropped from these bills. Now, I'm pleased to have with me two of our dedicated members with whom I have had great pleasure to work on this project. Both are practitioners in the area, very knowledgeable, and have been major assets in the drafting of the legislation, Robin Pope and John Whitmer, who will tell you more about the bills. Also with us is Caitlin Dahlquist, and in the back, Phil Schradl of the commission. So they are all prepared to answer any questions that you may have.
Chair Barker and members of the House Judiciary Committee, my name is Robin Pope, and I've appeared in front of you before. I'm an attorney in private practice, and for 25-plus years, my practice has focused on adoption and related issues. I'm a fellow and a member of the board of the American Academy of Adoption Attorneys. I've been a longstanding member of the Oregon State Bar Standing Committee on Adoption. This is my third law commission work group, and I'd have to say my favorite also. And I've also served as a volunteer pro tem judge in Oregon for close to 20 years. My practice is primarily adoption, and I represent birth parents at times. Sometimes I represent the adoptive parents. Sometimes I represent grandparents. At times I've represented children, and so I feel like I have a pretty broad knowledge of this area of law. House Bill 2365, I'll address first, and John is correct that this is primarily a housekeeping bill in terms of what happened with Senate Bill 623. Senate Bill 623 was a consensus bill of our very large, diverse work group. We had stakeholders from so many different groups, and the amazing thing is that we reached consensus on some very powerful issues that in other parts of this country, I mean, they can't do it, and we did it in Oregon. And I want to thank you today, because I think most of you were here, and I believe it passed the House unanimously. I want to thank you for passing Senate Bill 623. In the past year and a half, I have received numerous contacts from adoptive parents, adult adoptees, and birth parents who've said, thank you. We've finally been able to access our records. We've finally been able to make connections between this child that I gave birth to and placed for adoption. Those things have happened, and it was in part thanks to you supporting our consensus bill. We're really here just to ask you, after having made this sweeping change, because that's what you did, you swept away 57 years of secrecy in adoption when you helped us pass Senate Bill 623. 57 years, that's almost as many years as I am old. It was impressive. And I want us to continue that work. But what we just need to do now is clean it up a little bit. And that's primarily what so many of the changes in 2365 are. It's just a little dusting here, a little sweeping up there. And it's things that our different stakeholders have noticed in this last year plus of practice and of implementing 623. The second part of 2365 has to do with readoptions. And we haven't had a framework in our statutory process for readoption. There's this very kind of odd little law that talks about it but doesn't provide any guidance. So we've sort of cobbled things together over the years. DHS has worked with us. We private attorneys have tried to figure it out. The courts have worked with us. But there's nothing consistent. There's no framework that you can point to and say, this is how you do a readoption in Oregon. Readoptions are filed on a regular basis. If you look at the statistics from DHS, it's part of the number of adoptions that happen in Oregon every year. They're not going to stop. They will continue. And to have that framework would mean that all around the state, every court, the staff, the judges, DHS, the attorneys, the adopting parents, we would all have a consistent process. And that's what we've set forth in 2365 in the latter part of the bill. And we would ask that you would support both the housekeeping and the law improvement part of our bill. And thank you very much. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Barker, Chair Barker, and the members of the committee, my name is John Whitwer. Since 1975, I guess I claim seniority here. I've been doing this adoption work as a private practitioner in Sweet Home, Oregon, and have represented all the parties to adoptions at various times. I also sit on the standing committee of the Oregon State Bar's Family Law Section Adoption Work Group, which we've now renamed something, and I can't remember what it's renamed now. I wholeheartedly support both of these bills and solicit your support for them. I'd like to point out that the principle that John DiLorenzo introduced to you of opening records was one of the aspects of Senate Bill 623, but it also included some changes to Oregon law to help the Oregon Judicial Department respond to inquiries about sealed adoption records, help them respond in sensible ways that would not require a lot of decision-making by clerk staff, make it more automatic and less discretionary how those records are adopted. And so that was done by segregating an adoption filing into two parts, the sort of the open part and the closed part, making it easier to administer. And a lot of the problems that we're trying to cure here, and they're not big problems, but they are minor housekeeping problems, arose from that part of the bill. Just in changing the way that adoption filings look, what are the contents of adoption filings? Words were used that were not perhaps artfully as they should have been. Just in the drafting process, stuff got into the bill that shouldn't have been there, and we're now going back and fixing things, and then some other consequences occurred as a result. I would like to just point to Section 6, and I think I've got the right dash version of Senate Bill of House Bill 2365 as one example. It talks about compelling DHS or a licensed adoption agency in Oregon to reveal the jurisdiction, the venue for a case and a case number if that information is available to a person who is entitled to that information as a way of gaining access to sealed adoption records. You can understand a problem of a person confronting the many counties in Oregon, not knowing where an adoption might have been filed or a case number. One aspect of this bill that's being added is as an additional assist to these people looking for records to require those licensed agencies and Department of Human Services to reveal that information if it's available. So I just point that out as one type of the fixes. It's not a policy change in any sense of the word. It's just implementing what you did with Senate Bill 623. As to House Bill 2366, I'd just like to point one little case study here, and that has to do with consolidating fees in adoption filings. This may seem like an innocuous situation for you, but I'm just going to relate a couple of incidents from my own recent past in case filings in courts where we're not doing e-filing, where you don't electronically file. I got a phone call from the clerk saying, okay, we're ready to issue your certificate of adoption, which is a court-issued document certifying the adoption has been completed. By law, it has the same efficacy as a judgment of adoption. But it isn't the judgment. It's just a page certificate, sort of a nice certificate that families can hold and show that they've got an adoption completed. The fee prescribed for that is $1. So already we're talking about big-time dollars. And, of course, the telephone call from the clerk and the time it took my staff and the time it took me to respond, we could have paved the way to the courthouse with dollar bills and still come out ahead had we not had to have that conversation. So one of the fixes in the bills that are before you is to consolidate the filing fee, make it a simple process of allowing all that to be done away with. No more bookkeeping, no more accounting, no more checking for checks, no more mailing problems, just a cleanup bill in the aftermath of the other bills. I call it the great buzz from the little gnat, and that certainly is a case where law improvement is appropriate. I'd welcome any questions.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Samantha Benton, I think, is the only other witness I have.
Mr. Chair, when we begin to work this, we know what amendments we're working on and which bill.
We will.
We have two bills with a set of amendments on each. Is that right?
Yeah, it's 2365 with the proposed dash 3 and 2366 with the proposed dash 2.
Those are the two amendments.
This is what we're looking at right now, yes.
And we don't have the fiscals back on those yet, so we'll see if we get those and we can get that other left. Please go ahead.
And I would just note, actually, that there's minimal changes between the previous version and those.
Please.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Samantha Benton, and I am a family law analyst with the Oregon Judicial Department. And I've submitted some written testimony, so I'll keep my comments brief. First, I would like to thank the Oregon Law Commission for putting together the Adoption Records Work Group, especially Phil Schradel and his predecessor, Wendy Johnson, and the law clerks, Caitlin Dahlquist and Corey Driscoll. John DiLorenzo for chairing the work group and the many work group members who provided valuable knowledge and expertise. So in short, the Dash 3 and Dash 2 amendments remove the emergency clause, and this will allow the Oregon Judicial Department to make any fee changes during their regular yearly cycle instead of having to do it out of cycle, and that will reduce the administrative burden for the Judicial Department. And then additionally, the amendments to 2365 also clarify changes to the fees regarding multiple petitions for adoptions and readoptions. That's an instance where the petitioner will pay one fee for multiple petitions. So, Chair Barker and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, are there any questions? Thank you very much. Open a work session on House Bill 2365 first.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2365.
Representative Williamson moves the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2365. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Open a work session on House Bill 2366.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2366.
Representative Williamson moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2366. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And then we'll get the fiscal back on those and look for a future work session. So I'll close those hearings on 2365, 2366. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3490. Yes, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3490 comes to you from Representative Barton, who's going to come down and tell you all about it. House Bill 3490 prohibits a court from entering an order of child support from one parent to another when the parent who would be ordered to pay proves by clear and convincing evidence that the child for whom support would be ordered was conceived through rape by the parent receiving support. This prohibition applies regardless of which parent is awarded custody of the child, and the measure does not require a conviction for applicability. You do have the proposed Dash 1 amendments in front of you, which would require a conviction of rape in order to apply.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the Judiciary Committee. For the record, I am Brent Barton. I represent House District 40. And this bill, which is brought before you, as you can see, it's actually a fairly simple, straightforward bill. I'd like to acknowledge the assistance of counsel for helping me prepare this, and I believe also preparing the amendments at your request, Mr. Chair. This bill comes at the request of a constituent who approached me earlier with really an unbelievable and horrific story. She alleges that she is a victim of repeated sex crimes, and that in the course of those sex crimes, she bore a child. And she also alleges that the perpetrator of these crimes, I gather, has some means, financial means, and in subsequent litigation proceedings, he was able to lawyer up while she was not, and custody was not awarded custody, and indeed has to pay child support. Now, as you might imagine, for a woman feels she was the victim of horrific sex crimes to then be ordered to pay child support on top of that. It really feels like insult to injury. So that is why we are here today, why I introduced this bill. Now, I want to acknowledge some of the concerns I've heard from not just you, Mr. Chair, but also other people in the committee. The bill is written, does not require any kind of conviction or formal finding of that sex crimes. I believe that that's why you introduced the amendment. I acknowledge I haven't really talked about that. I don't know how that would affect my constituent or not, but that is an issue. Again, it's a legitimate point that I'm happy to continue working with you and other members of the committee. I've also heard from other members about retroactivity or not. I gather that might be a less salient issue, but again, I'm happy to work with you or any other members of the committee trying to help my constituent. Having said that, thank you for hearing the bill, Mr. Chair. If I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll have testimony from
Okay.
Or do you have a question of the representative?
No, other than the fact that if the facts are as they're spoken to be, it seems almost unbelievable that a judge wouldn't have access to knowing the facts and act accordingly. It's just...
These are the dash ones, right? So, Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, you need to talk to your constituent about the amendments, or do you need more time with this? Are you okay with the amendment to be moved into the bill today? I guess I'm just trying to figure out where we are in the process with making sure that you've got what you need for us to do anything.
Chair Barker and Vice Chair Williamson, thank you for the question. Actually, today was the first time I've seen the dash one, although I knew that they were coming as a result of several conversations I've had with Mr. Barker. I've not yet had time to discuss those with my constituent. Hour is getting late in the legislative session. However, if we could not move that today, I would appreciate it.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I was hearing.
Thank you for the question.
Correctly. Thank you.
All right. Okay. You don't want that amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Call Christine.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Christine Van Order. Thank you for allowing me to speak on this issue. I agree that one of the hardest parts during this process is not being able to get the truth to the judge. My attorney in that matter said that character evidence was not admissible in a child support and that it didn't matter. He did, during the hearing, was able to, for the first time, make the judge aware of my age and his age during the at the time of conception of the child, and was quickly by the other side. There was a quick objection from the other side. There was a second hearing where, because of my non-payment of child support, I was actually held in contempt and was made to pay his attorney's fees. Also, during that first hearing where it was determined that I would be paying child support, my attorney in that matter did not file in a timely manner, so I was hit with almost $7,000 in attorney's fees. So it's compiling because of a breakdown in the very beginning of the process that made it impossible for me to be able to tell my story, for me to be able to get the district attorney more involved. Only after that first judge made her ruling did someone from the DA's office go make her aware. And then she went into a very lengthy opinion kind of backing what she had already ruled on. That was Judge Chanty out of Lane County, Suzanne Chanty. And then the second one was the contempt, and it was Judge McAlpine, that's how it's spelt. And he literally told me while on the stand, because I was pro se, so I wasn't, you know, I was like, well, I'm not going to put any more money towards all these attorneys. I can just get up there and do it myself. So I kind of had a lot more leeway to be able to let the judge know what the facts of the case were. And he literally told me that it would take legislation in order for me to get out of this horrendous situation of having my family's entire financial future being held pretty much hostage because someone a long time ago was much more powerful and very capable of manipulating the system. I saw it the entire time I was with him. I can assure you right now, nobody's going to get convicted of, you know, a swipe on the cheek for a sex abuse one, because his first round of rapes were, he pled down from rape charges to sex abuse too. And so, you know, just because the actual conviction does not necessarily give you an accurate picture of what the crime was. Because in a second one, another girl that came after me, another victim after me, he was actually able to plead down to rape 3 and delivering marijuana to a minor for what should have been a long list of Measure 11 crimes. So I have a hard time thinking that there is going to be some terrible miscarriage of justice on the part of sex offenders, that they're going to get, you know, unfairly slammed or unfairly prosecuted, because it seems from beginning to end everything is pretty much in their favor. I heard someone earlier bring up borderline personality disorder. That's something that he used to tell me that I had. He used to tell me that I was crazy. And so, you know, when I hear all these, you know, and I've had to deal with over the years all of the character assassinations, I've had to deal with everything, you know, to try to discredit me as a victim. And I'm 37 years old, and it's happened a long time ago. I have moved forward, and my life is pretty awesome right now, and it just keeps getting better. Unfortunately, I have to keep getting notes from my doctor about my PTSD in order to not get my license suspended for non-payment of child support. Even when I was working, every time I got a check and it said, you know, deduction of the child support, it was a reminder. You know, I've had to mourn the loss of my son over and over. I've had to relive all the times that, as long as I took the abuse, I could be a mom. And that for him to actually be able to make good on all of his threats, to take my son legally and with no one batting an eye, because when you have money, you can do stuff like that. And I was very damaged, so I'm pretty sure I didn't make a very good witness. But I'm telling the truth. And it does seem unbelievable. I think that's the most horrendous part of it, is because it actually is true. And even though I have emailed you and a little bit of the details, that's only just a little tiny itty-bitty snippet. There's no way I can sum up what nearly 5 years of psychological shackles, you know, did to me. But this is, I can tell you right now, there are minor victims of sex trafficking that conceived a child while they were out on the streets with no control and no power over their own bodies. And I can tell you one that's at Coffee Creek right now, and she was 17 when she had her child. Her pimp was murdered, and so there's no way to get a conviction out of him. So requiring a conviction would have to, you know, by requiring a conviction, you'd have to say, well, our system's perfect and there's no way these guys can slip through, which I think that we've seen more often than not that they do slip through. You cannot Google his name. You will not find him anywhere on sex offender registry. He has completely been able to go off the grid and just live a very peaceably quiet life. You know, to require a conviction for this, it's just you'd have to go and you'd have to do so much. I mean, just like with the statute of limitations, you know, you'd have to do something to open a new window for prosecution if you're going to require a conviction. You have to make that possible.
It would really be difficult to do. And thank you for sending that information to us ahead of time as well. We really appreciate that.
Yeah.
And obviously we'll need to do some more work, and I'll continue to work with Representative Barton.
Super. On this, so.
Anybody have any questions or anything? Well, thank you again very much for coming down and giving us your testimony.
Great, thank
we'll
you.
Keep working on it. Thank you. Okay, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3490. Any other business come before the committee? We stand adjourned. Thanks again. Okay. Thanks again.